Herzlich willkommen zum OMR-Podcast. Unser Partner diese Woche erneut, die Deutsche Post. Und zwar vollkommen zu Recht, denn die machen dort einige abgefahrene, erfolgreiche Sachen. Zum Beispiel im Bereich Automobil, den Elektrotransporter oder im Bereich digitales Marketing bieten sie nun offene Schnittstellen an. Und das ist mal wirklich hilfreich, denn man kann jetzt als Brand oder als größerer Marketeer mit seiner Marketing-Automation-Software sich direkt an die Deutsche Post quasi ankoppeln und damit Print-Mailings vollkommen automatisch und trotzdem individualisiert aussteuern. Also auf jeden Empfänger persönlich ein Printmailing zuzuschneiden und das in die Customer Journey rein zu integrieren. Also, ne, dass man dann sehen kann, wie das funktioniert und das im Gesamtkonzert seiner digitalen Marketingaktivitäten mit bewerten kann, mit beobachten kann, mit steuern kann. Das ist mal neu. Auf einmal wird er sich sozusagen Print digital dank der Deutschen Post und dann dank den Schnittstellen zu den Automation-Systemen, die es so gibt auf der Welt. Also, das könnte sinnvoll sein. Genauso könnte es sinnvoll sein, sich dazu den Vortrag anzuhören. Bei uns demnächst auf dem OMR Festival am 7. und 8. Mai gibt es Paper is the New Digital als Masterclass und es gibt einen großen Stand der Deutschen Post. Geht da vorbei, informiert euch, setzt euch in die Masterclass. Auf geht's!
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Ganz kurz vorab, was war los bei OMR diese Woche und was war los bei mir? Ich konnte ja nicht das Gespräch mit Martin Sorrell führen. Wie kann das sein, wenn wir die Chance haben, Martin Sorrell zu sprechen? Warum war dann der Flo Heinemann da? Also nicht nur der Flo Heinemann, sondern der Flo Heinemann und nicht ich. Das lag daran, dass wir an dem Abend, als wir den treffen konnten, letzten Dienstag in London, hier eine Veranstaltung hatten, die lange geplant war mit Partnern, mit Gästen, mit Influencern auf der Bühne in einer Galerie hier in Hamburg und ich hatte keine Chance, nach London zu kommen und mir dann überlegt, naja, wer könnte es denn vielleicht machen? Und ich hatte mitbekommen, dass der Flo derzeit einige Zeit in England verbringt und habe ihn dann kurz gefragt und bingo. Am Ende haben die beiden sich getroffen. Ich selber bin kurz nach dem Abend hier in Hamburg noch für einige Tage nach New York geflogen, um da ein paar Leute zu treffen und auch eine Geschichte zu machen oder an einer Geschichte zu arbeiten über eine der erfolgreichsten deutschen Rap-Crews, 187, die witzigerweise eigentlich hier aus Hamburg kommen, aber jetzt aktuell in New York sind. Und naja, so haben wir uns dann da getroffen und ich habe da an der Geschichte gearbeitet. Bin dann aber am Montag zurück. Ja, und jetzt geht's los. Es kommt eine Woche voller spannender Podcast-Gäste, voller Action. Werdet ihr in den nächsten Wochen erleben. Jetzt zum Podcast selber vielleicht nochmal, wer den Flo Heinemann noch nicht hier bei OMR in den letzten Jahren irgendwo erlebt hat, auf der Bühne, im Podcast oder sonst wo, dem sei ganz kurz gesagt, eine Koryphäe des deutschen oder des europäischen Digitalmarketings sicherlich, Gründungsgeschäftsführer von Rocket Internet, Project A Ventures gegründet, den Venture-Fonds, zahlreiche Firmen mit aufgebaut in der frühen Phase, Zalando, Trivago, sitzt im Beirat von About You. Und naja, ist halt ein langjähriger Bekannter und Freund hier der Plattform. Und Martin Sorrell ist vielleicht die Legende im Media- und Marketinggeschäft weltweit, hat die WPP Agenturgruppe, also eines der größten Agenturnetzwerke der Welt, aufgebaut, zusammengekauft, sehr viel M&A gemacht, ist jahrelang irgendwie 50 Millionen Dollar Jahreseinkommen gehabt, dem gehören noch 2% von WPP, ist da jetzt aber vor einem Jahr auch relativ geräuschvoll ausgeschieden, hat wieder jetzt schon älter von über 60 eine neue Firma gegründet, neues Netzwerk, das jetzt schon, kommt im Podcast gleich auch irgendwie raus, schon ein paar hundert Millionen wert ist, hat da sehr viel Kapital in die Hand genommen, wieder zusammenzukaufen mit einer etwas anderen Ausrichtung. Über all das werden die beiden gleich sprechen. Der Martin Sorrell hat einen Wahnsinnsüberblick über die ganze Marketing- und Medienbranche der Welt. Und es war ganz lustig, der Flo hat mir nach dem Podcast geschrieben, man muss dem Martin Sorrell eigentlich ein Stichwort geben und dann redet er los. Und ungefähr war es auch so. Du sagst ihm einen Firmennamen oder ein Buzzword und dann geht's los. Also der Podcast ist, glaube ich, nicht ganz einfach gewesen, aber ich fand ihn trotzdem hörenswert und wünsche euch jetzt viel Spaß. Auf geht's!
Yeah, thanks a lot for being here, Sir Martin Sorrell.
Sure. Hi.
Definitely one of the key figures in the advertising media industry.
Maybe in my own mind, I don't know anybody else's mind.
Well, I think also quite objectively, you've shaped the industry for the last decades. And you're up for
a few decades.
And you're up for a new adventure.
We're
going to talk about that.
Our third iteration.
Okay. What was actually the first then?
Well, the first one was Saatchi's, where I was. I was CFO or Group Finance Director for 9 years, and that was really about globalization. I remember Maurice Saatchi running into my office with a waving an article by Theodore Levitt in the Harvard Business Review in 1983, which was about globalization, the theory being, and Theodore Levitt admitted, sadly he died a few years ago, but he admitted before he died that he over-egged the pudding or went to an extreme. But he basically said consumers would consume things in the same way everywhere, so which proved not to be true, and he didn't really want it to be true, but it was a thesis. I mean, certainly it was true directionally that people were, you know, were increasingly looking at things in a similar way in some product categories and service areas on a worldwide basis. So that was the first iteration. The second was WPP, Wire and Plastic Products. And the third is S4 Capital. Yeah. So Wire and Plastic Products was about globalization, continued globalization, and the beginnings of technology, and that bucket too, because there are two buckets. One is technology, in my view, and one is geography. I mean, you can boil everything down to that. It may sound like motherhood and apple pie, but I think it's true. And then the third iteration is S4 Capital, which is about technology.
Yeah. And you're taking a quite a similar approach, if I may say that, to the one you took at WPP.
Well, no, I think that's not true, actually.
No, not content-wise. Not, I think that's completely different. But structurally, you're starting
but structurally you're not. We're taking I mean, there are four key principles surrounding S4 Capital. Firstly, is we're purely digital. Mm-hmm. So that's very different to what we did with WPP, where we were analog and digital. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that we're very focused on three areas, what we call the Holy Trinity. So first-party data, fueling or driving content, and driving or fueling media planning and buying or programmatic. The third is that, you know, we have a tagline, faster, better, cheaper.
Yeah.
Faster means, you know, in an always-on environment, digital environment, you have to be responsive. You know, you're proactive and you're reactive too. It's rather, I liken it to running an election campaign without an electoral date, because it's a very always-on, 24/7 environment. Better means better use of technology and being able to use technology aggressively. That would make, might be AR or VR or AI or voice or whatever it is, but being aware of all the technologies and agnostic about them and applying them. And cheaper means being more efficient. I mean, and although ZBB is probably under attack now, zero-based budgeting, because of what's happened to certain companies that have propagated that. The people running those companies are very smart, and they will adapt the model to invest more in brand and to invest more in innovation. So that's, you know, a very different approach to what we did with WPP. And the fourth point is unitary structure. Yeah. We're trying to bring our operations together, because what clients want is the best people working on their business. They don't care where it comes from. We care as an industry, you know, about our brands and about our verticals, but clients don't. Clients want the very best people working on their business. So I would say S4 Capital is very different to Warren Plastic Products, which in, well, I think Warren Plastic Products was closer to the Saatchi model, if you like, the so-called holding company model.
Yeah, I think, I mean, content-wise, you're definitely taking completely, or strategy-wise, completely different approach. What I meant initially was, you're also doing a kind of deal, reverse IPO listing type approach.
Well, yes, but that's those are the details. I mean, you know, structurally, the board consists of four non-executive directors. We have the four principals of Mighty Hive and Media Monks, myself, and then Peter Rademacher, who was the CFO of Media Monks, who's come into the parent company or S4 Capital. So it's a very different structure. We didn't have any operational people on the WPP board, which maybe we should have done.
Yeah.
Maybe life would have been different if that was the case. But no, it's a different structure, a different strategy, and a different structure. I mean, which it should be, because times have changed significantly.
But would you consider also, I mean, if you look at companies like Uber or Airbnb, etc., they all stay private as long as they can. And you chose a completely opposite kind of approach by saying,
well, I enjoy dealing with the different stakeholders, if you like, surrounding a public company. I think you also, access to the public markets, the listed markets, gives you an ability to move faster. I mean, we moved very fast in the first 5 or 6 months.
Absolutely. I mean, your market cap is $500 million already, right?
Yeah, so yeah, $600 million or £460 million. So, you know, that's gives us a SPAC in America, which is sort of similar to what we did here in the UK. Mm-hmm. Take longer, it's more complicated. You can do bigger initial fundings, mm-hmm. but SPACs, which is basically raising money for a, you know, undisclosed mm-hmm. or unfleshed out mm-hmm. Opportunity or opportunities, has been done by several people. I mean, talented people can put SPACs, but they don't, you know, it's sort of at random in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say this is as good as any. Doing the private equity route or doing the venture capital route, I think it puts management under pressure. I've seen people in venture capital and private equity give away too much of the equity mm-hmm. And give away control. We have a golden share in a sense in the context of S4 Capital, which is different to WPP. I've had a golden share at WPP. Again, things may have been different. But, you know, I've still got my shareholding in WPP, which is about 2% of the capital. I'm the largest individual investor in WPP still, mm-hmm. despite, you know, what's happened and the challenges that WPP faces. But I would say the model is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I differ a little bit with
you. Yeah, absolutely. But it's a very interesting approach. I think especially also it supports, if I understand it correctly, the unitary approach that you want to take.
Yes. Yeah.
Because
unitary approach is difficult because, you know, everybody is very proud of their brand. Everybody's, you know, if you start a business in the basement like Wes and Victor did 16 years ago or Pete did 6 years ago with Christopher Martin, you're very proud of your brand and you don't want to surrender that history and that culture and that approach, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. Average age of the Mighty High people is about 25. Mm-hmm. Average age of the Medium Monks people is about 33. Mm-hmm. Medium Monks has 950 people and Mighty High has about 250. So we have, you know, 1,200 in total in 16 countries. But, you know, everybody likes their own culture. I mean, do I worry about S4 Capital as a brand? Yes, but it's more of a stock market financial brand than it is a trading brand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mighty Monks mm-hmm. or M3H would be good branding,
yeah,
in my view. But what do I know about branding?
Let's talk a little bit about the companies that you bought.
Well, we merged with because the structure was the consideration was half shares, half cash. Mm-hmm. We cashed out the institution. So in the case of Medium Monks, 52% were owned by Ben Kiss, which is the private equity arm. Mm-hmm. It used to be a Fortis, the management bought it out. And in the case of Mighty High, 15% was institutionally owned. We took the institutions outside investors out for mm-hmm. cash. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Medium Monks, 48%. In the case of Mighty High, 85%, including the mm-hmm. historic management of people who moved on at Mighty Hive, we took out for half shares, half cash. Mm-hmm. So every one of the principals has a significant shareholder.
Okay, to support the unitary structure.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little, like, why did you choose these companies?
Part of it was I knew of Media Monks from McKinsey, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I went to a McKinsey conference in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. in the church there. I thought it was a strange place to have a McKinsey first European partners meeting, and after I finished my little presentation, one of the partners there said to me, "You ought to have a look at MediaMax, an interesting mm-hmm. company, mm-hmm. doing things in a different way." And in fact, actually, one of the strategy partners of McKinsey was very helpful to me and to us in that process. Mm-hmm. So that was MediaMax. So a little bit of serendipity, and mm-hmm. you know, they were putting the company up for auction, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it was actually up for auction. And it shows you how private equity sometimes works to its disadvantage. You know, they like to talk to one another to trade information, as do venture capital companies do. But sometimes it can bite you in the backside. So what a private equity company, when I left WPP in the middle of May, private equity guy wrote to me and said, "Well, we're looking at this company, digital company, in the UK or wherever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would you like to work with us on it?" As I have nothing to do, you know, mm-hmm. they thought I had nothing to do. So I said, yes. I said, "But, you know, what is it?" And he told me it was Media Monks. I said, "Well, I know Media Monks. Let me ring up Victor mm-hmm. and find out whether he objects to me working with you on it." Mm-hmm. And, you know, Victor and I spoke. Victor said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to start S4 Capital." And he said, "Well, why don't we try and do something together?" So that was one. Mm-hmm. On having done sort of Media Monks, or having a mighty hive. It's probably a little bit less serendipity in the sense that the, you know, we were a known quantity because we've said we'd laid out our agenda, the 4 points that I mentioned to you, particularly the purely digital part. And then the you know, the first party data driving content and media planning and buying. And, you know, so it was, that was a natural one for us to get involved in with Mighty Hive. But both companies were sort of, quotes unquote, expensive. Same structure with Mighty Hive. We did it on Christmas Eve of last year. You know, half shares, half cash. And the key determinant of what we're doing and what we will do in the future is always in relation to these deals, as people insist on calling them, is the essential thing will be, does the management want to sell out? If they do, we're not interested. Do they want to buy in? If they do, we're really interested.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
Kurzer Hinweis auf Blinkist. Wer uns regelmäßig hört, kennt Blinkist bereits. B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Der Gründer war vor einigen Monaten mal hier bei uns im Podcast zu Gast. In jedem Fall geht es darum, dass man 2.500 Bücher in aller Kürze verstehen kann. Also pro Buch dauert es ungefähr 15 Minuten und man bekommt die Kerninhalte und Kernbotschaften eines Buches entweder als Audio oder zum Lesen zugeführt via Blinkist. Das macht auf jeden Fall eine ganze Menge Sinn, weil nicht jedes Buch muss man in voller Länge genießen. Ich habe vor kurzem zum Beispiel mal wissen wollen, was in dem Buch die Psychologie sexueller Leidenschaft, was da drin steht, und habe dann halt 15 Minuten lang Blinkist gehört. Ich werde es nicht verraten, ihr müsst es euch selber anhören. Also geht zu Blinkist, beziehungsweise geht zu blinkist.com/OMR und probiert es mal aus. Gibt es halt auch Bücher aus anderen Bereichen, wer auf sowas nicht steht. Da geht es dann um Marketing und Vertrieb, um Achtsamkeit, Gesundheit. Es gibt halt aus allen Bereichen Bücher. Man kann es aber beim Fahrradfahren hören, habe ich auch schon mal gemacht. Oder macht auch eigentlich, wenn man längere Fahrradfahrten mal macht, dann einfach dabei Blinkist hören oder Podcast hören. Aber vor allen Dingen jetzt halt Blinkist. Es gibt unter blinkist.de/OMR 20% Rabatt auf das Jahresabo, Blinkist Premium sozusagen. Man kann außerdem ein Probeabo abschließen. Das geht jederzeit und dann halt für einen befristeten Zeitraum Blinkist ausprobieren.
And is it fair to say that like the acquisition or the merge with Mighty Hive, is that a statement also from your, does it support your view that it's relevant for advertisers to be more in-housing stuff and be more competent?
Well, I think there's, you know, there's a confluence of a number of things that happen. First of all, prior to 2008, GDP growth, prior to Lehman, GDP growth was more significant. There was more inflation and was more significant in nominal terms. You know, if you look at the numbers, it's probably worldwide GDP was growing up about 3 or 4%, and now it's about 2 or 3%. And the principal reason why it's lower is because inflation is out of the system, and therefore our clients have, in a low growth environment, lower growth, have very little pricing power, which means they're very focused on cost, which means that they've stripped out a lot of the internal marketing resources. So that's one sort of set of things that happened. The other set, which has happened more recently, maybe as we got into 2016 and 17, and there were some changes we noticed in the marketplace, is that the walled gardens, you know, which dominate digital. I mean, digital is about $200 billion. Google of advertising revenues, about $125 billion is Google, about 52-53 is Facebook. And then you drop down to Amazon at around 10, probably at 10, at 10, probably growing a little bit faster now, about $12 billion, or $3 billion in the last quarter. But it's dominated by Facebook and Google. And of course, in China, it's dominated by Alibaba and Tencent. Their unwillingness to share data for whatever reason, I think for good reason, because, you know, for genuine reasons around brand safety, fake news, the political issues, you know, the interference in elections, you know, all the things, you know, the tragic events in New Zealand, and indeed in Holland, in Utrecht, I mean, are all driving people to say, you know, those platforms need to be more socially responsibility and monitor their content. But the net result of that is they are unwilling to share the data. So the walls are getting bigger.
Yeah.
At the same time as the walls got bigger, you know, direct to consumer has become more and more important. Clients saw the internet as the way of establishing a direct relationship with consumers. And along, you know, with the demise of fixed retailers, brick retailers, I think, you know, our clients saw for the first time, particularly in FMCG, the opportunity to go direct to clients, to consumers, and build relationships. with the platforms starting to invade that territory, the e-retailers, the platforms I mentioned, the fearsome five, as I call them, I referred to, that's put a block on our clients reaching the consumer. So they started to get much more interested in how they can use first-party data to fuel their content and to fuel their media planning and buying in the way that we've set up S4 Capital. And so it's a there's a sort of a unfortunate comparison to Brexit. You know, the tagline for the Brexit campaign was take back control. And I think clients are trying to take back control of their own destiny. They've denuded their resources, and at the same time, they need more resources to reach the consumer. And, you know, when Unilever buys Dollar Shave Club, or when Coca-Cola buys Costa, or when Nestle buys Starbucks, what it's telling you is they're trying to build a more direct relationship with consumers. So their control of data is the battleground. That's the big fight. And it's the unwillingness of the platforms for good reasons. I'm not saying bad reasons. Nefarious reasons, for good reasons, unwillingness to share, that is driving the clients to establish this new model, which S4 Capital represents.
Yeah. So, would it be a fair conclusion that if you see that direct customer relationships are a key to survive in a kind of platform dominated economy, that CRM would be another angle where you could enter?
You can call it. We are there. Mm-hmm. I mean the rise of internet advertising. So if you look at the advertising and marketing services market, it's about $1 trillion of spend. Mm-hmm. There's a bit recent circular. PwC put some figures together with a company called Redburn, which is an analyst, Bianca Dalal, suggesting that the market was 1.7 trillion, of which 400 billion, the incremental 700 billion, 400 billion came from trade budgets, which is where Amazon is focused. I mean, for people don't understand that Amazon is really focused on trade budgets and the long tail, not the big companies and necessarily in their ad budgets. But if you assume it's 1 trillion, exclude the trade budgets, if you like. About half of that 500 billion is in old stuff, including the digital interloping, and 500 billion is in market research and public relations and whatever. And, you know, that online growth of that 200 billion market is growing by 20% per annum. The overall stuff, the old trillion or 1.7 trillion, only growing by about 3 or 4%, 2 or 3%. So we're in the sweet spot of the industry. I mean, what we've chosen, you know, when I left WPP, I sort of looked at WPP, which is a $20 billion portfolio, and said, where's the growth? I followed the McKinsey article, actually, which was, you know, in trying to find out what made companies great or what made them sustainable or what were the long term. You know, they looked at the FTSE 100, they look at the S&P 500 and say, you know, today in comparison to 25 or 30 years ago, there are very few companies left. Why are those companies left? And McKinsey's diagnosis, unfortunately, it wasn't a brilliant CEO. It wasn't, thankfully, cost cutting. It was finding where the revenue growth is. That's the principal determinant. So when I left WPP, I said, well, you know, where is the growth? And it struck me there were three areas. First is panel data, first-party data. So a Kantar World Panel or a Lightspeed, which is the online panel. Secondly, digital content. So VML and AKQA or Wonderman and Ogilvy One, if you could reconstruct that. And then finally, media planning and buying, digital media planning and buying around Essence and around Xaxis. So those three areas were the high growth areas. That's what, you know, the 20% areas. Yeah. Last year, we just announced our results yesterday on a pro forma basis. The group grew by 50%, 60% on the revenue line, 50% on the gross profit line, and 100% on profit line. And earnings per share were almost tripled. So, you know, it shows you that what you have to do is try and figure out the growth spots.
And what does it tell us about the traditional agency model? I mean, if it's...
Well, it tells you that the traditional... They're not zombie companies. It tells you they have to change. And the question is, how do you make that change? If you look at the four big holding companies, you put Dentsu to one side, which I think is the best positioned of the six holding companies because of its focus on media, on digital, and on data with Merkle, etc. Havas has sort of disappeared into Vivendi. So, I mean, actually, technically, Vivendi is the biggest at around 30 billion euros. But you look at the top four, you have two based in the US, IPG and Omnicom, that seem to be doing better than the two based in Europe, which is WPP and publicists. Why? Well, I think there are two basic reasons. Firstly, the two Americans are based in the US, which after all, whether you like it or not, is still the biggest market in the world. It's 20 trillion of GDP out of 70 trillion, roughly. And the next is China at 10 or 11, 12 trillion. So US is still the center, the biggest market, and it's also where the big multinationals are based. So you could argue this has a disproportionate influence. You know, an hour in New York, in theory, you know, 20 trillion versus the UK, say, 3 trillion is about seven times more productive. You know, on law of averages, it would be seven times more productive than being, you know, in a one of the European big five, including Germany. So this focus, you know, the US is still, you know, critically important in people's thinking. And you know, beyond the US, obviously China is the second largest market, about 10 or 11 or 12 trillion. So having that US dominance or US position is very important from the point of view of those two US companies. And the other thing is those two US companies, IPG and Omnicom, have invested in their brands. They've chosen not to consolidate the brands. WPP and Publicis, however, have consolidated their brands because they believe one firm in the end, and I think they're probably right, in the end, will be better. So I think the strategy is better than the American strategy. Unfortunately, when you put one and one together inside our industry, often you get one and a half or one or even less than one. And that's a problem. And so you have short-term, maybe medium-term dislocation. So, you know, WPP looks to have difficulties, Publicis looks to have difficulties, but maybe in the long run it'll come out right because being one firm, like a McKinsey, you know, one brand, even though I think they have digital at McKinsey.
Yeah.
But,
it's called McKinsey Labs or something.
I would call it McKinsey Digital. I wouldn't have bothered about that. But whatever, having a single brand is really important.
And when it comes to the business model, are you following still the same model in the sense like percent of ad spend or percent of the billings? Or are you also considering...
Sorry, in what way?
Basically, the money that the advertising agency makes, I mean, basically comes from two sources. It's from percent of ad spend and it's the trading model. Percentage of billings
is, you know, that's gone. I mean, that the way that agencies are paid basically is time of staff. And so it's a direct salaries, indirects, overhead, and a margin for profit. And thereby hangs the problem for the traditional agency groups that we just discussed because their structures tend to be older, tend to be more traditional, more analog than digital. And they built in costs either at a direct salary level or an overhead level, which are disproportionate to new environment. Zero-based budgeting is about starting from scratch. And in a way, S4 Capital is a zero-based budgeter because we started from scratch, or Media Monks has, and Mighty Have has, and so they haven't had the time to get into bad habits, if I put it like that. So I would say the model is more efficient. Our model is more efficient. It's not about percentage of advertising or billings or whatever. It's about having a more efficient, leaner structure and not overburdening it with too much direct cost or indeed overhead.
Would you say that it's relevant that agencies in the future invest a lot more in their own proprietary tech stack?
We are not. I mean, we're deliberately. I mean, trying to figure out, you know, what is the best ad tech or martech is terrifyingly difficult, certainly for me. I'm not an engineer, software engineer, or an engineer, and therefore I would find it extremely difficult to pass a view on that. We want to be agnostic on that. I mean, maybe at the fringes we might have some ad tech or martech, but you know, at its heart, no. What we're using is the best ad tech, the best martech for our clients. You know, and if you look at the platforms, I mean, there's no doubt that Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tencent, Alibaba are superb platforms. I mean, they dominate. They virtually account for all of that 200 billion of spend. And they are the key platforms and unlikely to be replaced. I mean, the only third force to Google and Facebook is Amazon. And Amazon is attacking both Google and Facebook in search. 55% of US searches already emanate from Amazon in one way or another. Attacking them on social as well as Facebook and lesser extent Google. And of course, they're trying to get an increasing proportion, not just of the marketing budgets, but as I said, the sales budgets.
But what would be your view on companies like the Trade Desk that have been very successful over the last few years?
Well, yes, but on a much, much smaller level. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tried, it's an interesting question. We had at WPP a stake in AppNexus, mm-hmm. Brian O'Kelly's AppNexus, yeah. which is now part of AT&T. Mm-hmm. Another one of our ex-people, Brian mm-hmm. Lesser, mm-hmm. purchased AppNexus, in which WPP was a shareholder. And I tried, Villa Longa, the ex-CEO of Telefonica, had a big stake in the Trade Desk. Mm-hmm. And I tried, remember, tried to orchestrate a meeting between Brian O'Kelly and the guy who runs Trade Desk with Villa Longa. Mm-hmm. It was a disastrous meeting, which was a shame, actually, because if the two had got together,
absolutely.
That would have been an interesting sort of third force, if you like. But we'll see what happens to the Trade Desk, whether it can continue. They've done an incredibly good job.
Yeah.
But we'll see whether it can continue to.
I think the market cap is like $6 billion, so that's quite impressive.
Hold on a second. Can I remind you what Google's market cap is?
Yeah, absolutely.
So can I remind you what Facebook's is?
Yeah, times 100 or 80
Amazon's,
or whatever it is. Yeah, that's right.
Amazon's did cross a trillion, so good luck, I'd say.
So right now, your recommendation to young aspiring entrepreneurs would not be
Chinese and learn code. that's it.
Okay, that's probably a good recommendation. Don't get into ed tech unless you really know what you're doing or you have a really rich day.
So like Lex this morning in the FT, you talked about mm-hmm. Our model being was actually complementary and said mm-hmm. it sort of caught the wind in terms of what major clients like Procter and Unilever were saying. Mm-hmm. In terms of the need for the model, the mm-hmm. first party data driving content and media. However, they finished by saying, well, of course, but the challenge is, can you take margin from Google or Facebook? That misunderstands that mm-hmm. basically we don't take margin from Google or Facebook. Mm-hmm. We, in a way, stimulate the use mm-hmm. of digital media, mm-hmm. whichever medium is the best for our client, whether it be Google and DoubleClick or Facebook mm-hmm. or Amazon or Alibaba or Tencent or Trade Desk or whatever it happens to be. Because, mm-hmm. Some of our clients insist on using the Trade Desk and they won't use Google. Mm-hmm. Some of them, are Amazon in favor of Amazon. Some of them not in favor of Amazon and shy away from Amazon. Mm-hmm. So there are different horses for different courses. But basically, it misunderstands, we are building close relationships. They are frenemies in a sense, mm-hmm. but they're certainly friendlier frenemies, the platforms, mm-hmm. are friendlier frenemies today than they were, mm-hmm. partly because of the regulatory pressure they've been put under, particularly in the case of Google and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, I think Google and Facebook have made significant efforts to try and deal mm-hmm. with this. Facebook has hired, 30,000 people?
Yeah.
Google...
Really 10, becoming 15. A media company, which
they are. Yeah, but the first point is a good observation. Mm-hmm. That the first thing I have to do is acknowledge that they are media companies. Mm-hmm. They are media companies. Yeah. They are responsible. With the tragic events around New Zealand, we see that they have to acknowledge mm-hmm. that they bear a responsibility for the content that flows through their pipes. They can't claim, we're digital engineers tightening the nuts on the digital pipes.
And they have the margin to afford it, to be
well, able to that's it. Also a very good observation. They are they have the market cap and they have the margins to do it. What is the marginal cost of another search? Zero.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hinweis auf Seins. Was soll Seins denn jetzt eigentlich sein? S-E-I-N-Z. Ist die neue Marke von DM für Männerpflegeprodukte, für Männerkosmetik. Die gibt's online und offline. Seins.com als Webshop und Informationsplattform für Männer rund ums Thema Kosmetik und Pflege und vor allen Dingen auch in allen fast 2000 DM-Filialen, die es in Deutschland gibt. 2000 Mal haben die ein Geschäft in Deutschland und überall gibt es demnächst einen Bereich, wo Männerprodukte ganz dezidiert angeboten werden. Da gibt es da die großen Marken Nivea Man, L'Oreal Man, Axe, Dove und wie es alles heißt. Aber es gibt auch viele kleine, ungewöhnliche Newcomer-Männermarken. Brooklyn Soap, Hawks und Brimble, Wildwuchs. Ihr werdet da was finden, was Spaß macht und was euch schöner aussehen lässt und gesünder und irgendwie euch pflegt. Bitte prüft beim nächsten DM-Besuch, beim nächsten Einkauf Seins. Auf geht's. Und außerdem, nicht vergessen, es gibt 10% Rabatt beim ersten Kauf unter seins.com/omr.
So how do you see companies like Adobe or partially Salesforce?
I talk about the Fearsome Five and then we had you know, the seven sisters would be with Apple and Microsoft, and then I don't know what you call about the 10, but you add the three software companies, Adobe, you add Oracle and Salesforce, and that makes the 10. I mean, maybe you add in IBM and SAP, you know, to make a dozen. But, you know, those are the companies that we are really focused on. Those are the companies that are a part of our ecosystem that we're focused on.
What is, I mean, you're also, if I understand it correctly, you have a pretty deep view also on what's happening in China. And what's probably also an interesting question, I mean, how are or are like Alibaba, Tencent, et cetera, are they will they enter the Western markets from your point of view?
Well, they were more interesting. If you look at their strategy, I remember Jack Ma saying in Shanghai many years ago, we did a session with him, and he said, I'm not going to go where you obviously think I will go, like the US or the highly competitive markets. I'll try and pick off the markets, it's him speaking, the trick, pick off the markets that are not, I don't know, Russia, Turkey, whatever it happens to be, but markets that are not obvious, you know, Egypt, whatever. North Africa, you know, pick up markets that are easier for them to penetrate and then go from there. So I don't, you know, basically Tencent and Alibaba dominate China. You know, there are contenders. You know, I was looking at ByteDance and TikTok and everything in relation to messaging and see there, but they're not, you know, it's not rather like, you know, the big three in the West. The Chinese government, I think it's just as concerned about the domination of Alibaba and Tencent as regulators in the West are. You know, they're worried about the control, the fame they have. I mean, there is a question raised often as to whether Jack Ma retired or was pushed in some way, because, you know, his persona and popularity in China was so strong. So there has been debate about that. But, you know, I don't know what the answer to that question is. But it does strike me that the Chinese government worries in the same way about the control of data that these
that is surprising. I think not really public perception.
So may not be, but I think that's my sense. And you know, maybe they're worried in a different way to Western governments. But Western governments now are really on. You know, Philip Hammond over the weekend on Andrew Ma's program talked about the dominance of the platforms, and how there had to be some regulation. I think he was talking in the context of the awful events in New Zealand. But, you know, clearly there has to be changes, and Mark Zuckerberg and Google, Pindar, Sundar and others acknowledge the need to have some sort of regulatory intervention. So whether it's Vestager at the EU or the FTC or whoever it is who does it, I mean, I think local governments or sort of national governments will increasingly look at regulation. Now, you have to have some sort of supranational policy, because otherwise it's like squeezing a balloon. You know, you squeeze it in one part and then it expands elsewhere. And it's obviously linked to taxation policy. You know,
it's like the digital tax that some people think they can impose locally.
Yeah, the platforms get criticized because they're not paying enough tax. Well, yeah, that's fine to criticize them, but I think, you know, what you have to do is to provide that on a multinational basis, because, you know, they'll just go to another jurisdiction. The other thing that's really interesting in the context of Brexit is that post-Brexit, I mean, the UK, I think, post-Brexit has to alter its trade pattern, you know, from away from the EU to the BRICS and Next 11. So Brazil, Russia, India, China, Next 11, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, you know, Colombia, Mexico, Argentina, whatever it happens to be. Africa, Middle East. To do that, you know, we're going to have to offer a lot of attractive opportunities. That could be around tax. It could be around light regulation. So, you know, maybe what we should do is prove to Google, Facebook, and Amazon this is a good home for them, rather than a bad home for them.
Yeah, very interesting kind of approach. That's probably
It's a Singaporean type of approach, which I would favor, but people say I'm crazy.
But Singapore obviously works,
I mean, yes, I mean, you know, I mean, but that's, it's controversial in some senses, as you well know. But, you know, actually the parallel is really interesting, because when Singapore, you know, took its independence from Malaysia, Lee Kuan Yew, you know, people said it can't work. It wouldn't work. I mean, if you look at the newsreels from that time, I remember it was the anniversary, I think the 50th anniversary or 60th anniversary, And looking at the black and white news reels, I mean, there were people who were saying, the naysayers were saying, it ain't going to work. Mm-hmm. And of course, look what has happened. Some people criticize the way it was done. I don't. I think it's a very good example. In comparison to the UK, it's a much smaller example. We're only talking about 5 million people versus 60 plus. So it is a very different scale, but it doesn't mean that we can't attempt the same.
Okay. Let's probably finish this off looking at one other company, Microsoft, from a different angle.
Done extremely well.
Absolutely.
Satya Nadella has done brilliant.
Quite surprising probably also to people like 10 years ago who probably would have thought.
Can I ask one
angle that I find interesting. Do you think that Microsoft could play, apart from the Azure activity, could play a role in B2B media, or B2B advertising?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is LinkedIn going to be like the Facebook
for BC? We'll see. I mean, I went and saw some of the LinkedIn people recently, and they seem to be very happy with the way the Microsoft deal has gone. Mm-hmm. But I think Microsoft is very interesting because when people talk about the regulation of, the fearsome five, mm-hmm. The people who benefit would be an Adobe, a Salesforce, and an Oracle, but it would also be Microsoft. Mm. So that's ironic given the history. But Microsoft is, if it's not the most, I think it's the most valuable company on the planet, maybe number two. And Satya Nadella has done a brilliant job, really, turning it from being a very vertical company to a horizontal company in the sense that the people inside Microsoft are working, I think, extremely well together, where maybe in previous regimes it was much more competitive internally. But no, I think they certainly can do what you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. And they are a force to watch, both in terms of their capabilities and their scale.
Cool. So thanks a lot for
your views. Thank you very much.
It was very interesting 35 minutes.
I hope the listeners find it interesting too.
Yeah, let's see. We'll get some feedback and pass it on to you. The good and the bad.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Cool, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ganz kurz, bevor alles vorbei ist, Hinweis auf den Paid Content Day. Natürlich an der Hamburg Media School machen wir gemeinsam am 29. Mai. Also wenn OMR schon Vergangenheit ist und man sich schon auf 2020 freut, dann gibt es zwischenzeitlich die Möglichkeit, zum Paid Content Day zu kommen. Da ist es natürlich so, Paid Content ist die Zukunft von Journalismus. Ich glaube, es ist nicht zu klein gegriffen, das so zu sagen. Und wie man am besten Nutzer gewinnt für Paid Content, wie man das umsetzt, wie das strategisch und taktisch und wirklich auch operativ marketingseitig funktioniert, das soll alles beim Paid Content Day am 29. Mai an der Hamburg Media School erklärt werden. Die DPA ist auch mit großem Team dabei. Ihr könnt euch anmelden und bekommt mit dem Code OMR/paid oder _paid 10% Rabatt auf den normalen Preis. Alle Informationen zum Paid Content Day gibt es unter hamburgmediaschool.com im Bereich Seminare.